oxygen. It's nature's oldest therapy and plays an essential role in destroying viruses, bacteria, mold, yeast, and fungus, and keeping the human body healthy and strong. Now, you can give your body and your immune system a mega boost of disease-fighting oxygen with all-natural Oxy-C. With so many people now leading a sedentary indoor lifestyle, most are in a chronic state of oxygen deprivation, which sets up a perfect environment for disease, general fatigue, and a host of other symptoms. Oxy-C is yours in simple, convenient capsules. Nothing to mix, nothing to hassle with. Take it with juice or water anytime. Feel a cold or flu approaching? Have no energy or spark anymore? Try all-natural Oxy-C and prepare to be amazed. Oxy-C is only available from New Earth Health Solutions at Rinse.com. Look for the New Earth banner at Rinse.com. The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rinse Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Boom, boom. It could be sooner than you think. It'll happen when the international Zionist Illuminati Freemason cult controllers want it to happen. If it happens, that's the game. And I really want to underscore this. I just know, I can't prove it, I just know this entire year, and probably every year, is blocked out in advance by them. They use computers now. They probably used to do it by hand, but they block out the years. News, global events, Western, Eastern, Southern, Northern conflicts, whatever, science, they block it all out. We live in a virtual reality. I don't think this reality is being allowed to manifest on its own. I think the control cannot be overstated. That's an issue that is intrinsic to understanding what's happening around you. And it's very easy for them to block out a year, especially a fun year like this one with the so-called election and all the political crap that's going on. Look, it's bread and circuses for the masses. I'm not knocking the masses. They don't really have a chance. It's not their fault that they're stupid. And they are stupid. They've been made stupid by staring at the goddamn television and all this commercial product, which is nothing more than product. Rare occasions, some of the History Channel programs, I understand that. But even history, as presented by the History Channel, is often corrupted. Look at the Hitler series, for example. Anyway, it's all scripted. And they're just moving right along, and they do a little tweaking here, a little tweaking there. But it's planned. It's called showbiz. It's like a movie. Think of each year as a movie, a major motion picture. And they just go along, and they make things happen. Anytime, any way, anyhow they want. And that's my personal view of it. I'm not speaking for my friend and colleague and first guest tonight, Don Jeffries. Hello, Don. Welcome back.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing? So you're saying basically the Illuminati has a Google Calendar, I guess, and they've got it all planned. I put my interviews on there, and I guess that's what they do.
Uh-huh.
Another false rumor of World War III this week. Okay.
Sure.
Crisis at the superseding the crisis. What happened? I mean, I actually turned on Fox News before coming on the show just because I thought maybe they'd talk about the crisis at the border, because, of course, that interests me, you know, with Abbott making these uncharacteristic, like, you know, Jefferson Davis.
Let me guess. Number five story, if at all.
No, it wasn't mentioned. He wasn't mentioned. It was just all, you know, possibility of Iran with the drone strikes or, you know, that war. You know,
they didn't even mention the Texas crisis.
No, it's all right. And that's what I said when I wrote my last Substack. I said, you know, this could easily just go to, because what they do now is, you're right, I mean, they maybe almost have a story every day on their Google calendars. And
yeah.
it just comes and goes. It just it's there for a day or two, maybe. And then it's gone. And it's, you know, I mean, Ukraine is kind of yesterday's news.
You got it.
Yeah.
You're right.
But
every bit of it's planned. Every day of the year is probably planned. On
yeah,
their
so
planner. They have a big daily planner, but it's on a computer screen now, and they just make it happen.
And you can we pretend there's something? I mean, they don't even, never even pretend anything's good's going to happen. It's always nothing but fear porn. I mean, they don't, at least Trump, I'll say one thing about Trump with his rhetoric, he would constantly give you false hope. Oh, you know, I might pardon Assange. You know, I might put troops at the border.
Yes, he's quite dependable in terms of his fraud. I understand.
Yeah, yeah, but these people, it's just nonstop. They don't dangle any. They're not dangling that carrot out ever. I mean, it's nonstop negativity and sacrifice World War III, and things are going to be worse. Tighten their belts even more, and American people have they've always stepped up in a crisis, and we're always in some kind of crisis. Always. Do we ever have any kind of, I mean, when was the last time we had the last time probably America had peace and prosperity would have been the 1920s, the roaring 20s, I guess, before the stock market hit. I don't know. I mean, basically from the time, it was kind of like that in the 70s, like, because I was fortunate enough to just miss the Vietnam War, you know, and I was, you know, I was, you know, preparing to go to Canada, and luckily it ended just in time. But and for the rest of that decade, I guess, it was, you know, there wasn't prosperity, but I guess there was kind of peace. But there's, you know, it's been that way forever. I mean, we're America's always waiting for a peace dividend that never comes because there's never peace. And
isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? Wait. We've in the history of this nation. We've only, I'm going to guess, I think I'm right, or very close. We've only not been at a state of war to one degree or another for 19 years of our history.
Yeah, something like that.
It's
90, well over 90, like 95 or something ridiculous amount of time.
Yep.
And, you know, it's you try to tell people that, but, you know, just like you try to explain our, you know, our money system to them, you know, it's like, you know, well, you got his car repossessed. He didn't make the payments. Well, you know, when they gave him that loan, right, that they didn't actually have the money. They created it out of thin air, right? And then they charged him interest on money they didn't even have. So I don't exactly think it's the moral position to go and confiscate the car because he didn't pay back money that wasn't even real to begin with. But I know I'm you know, same thing with mortgages. You're foreclosing on somebody. And again, they're lending you much larger amounts of money that they never had. But you try to tell the average citizen that, and they don't believe it. You know, it's J. Edgar Hoover, of all people, you know, a great conspirator himself. But he said in context of the communist conspiracy when he was writing the book, I forget what it was called, you know, about the communists in America. But he said, you know, the average person can't comprehend that there is anything, you know, this big, this sinister. It's beyond their comprehension. And we're still at that point. The average American can't comprehend it. If you try to tell them, explain our money system, well, you know, they don't. Well, they used to have a reserve system. That's what the reserve meant. But they used to be 10%. And now I don't think it's anything. So that means that it was bad enough when they were lending you, you know, money that they 90% of which they didn't have. So, you know, you come up and ask me for $100 and I have $10 in my wallet. And I'll lend you $100. I mean, I'll just create the $90 out of it. I'm going to charge you interest on it as well. That's our system. And, you know, when you get into hundreds of thousands of dollars for homes, then it really, it takes on a sinister meaning to me. And, you know, as a Catholic, it used to be, you know, the usury, which originally meant lending money and charging interest for it, any interest. Now it's been, they've kind of revised their definition to say it's usurious interest rates or excessive interest rates, whatever that means. That would be every credit card, right? But it used to be considered a mortal sin by the Catholic Church. And you have papal encyclicals going back. I think the last one was maybe the 1800s, Pope Leo or somebody. I can't remember the name, but that wrote, you know, an imprimatur against usury. Does anybody talk about that now? Our whole system is built on that. When you have a Federal Reserve system that the money's not, doesn't even exist, then the whole thing is. But you try to explain that to people, and it's beyond the comprehension of liberals. And conservatives are so locked into, you're going to need to pay your bills, pay your debts, you know, and they don't even understand that the debt was phony to begin with. So it's so getting them to understand anything is difficult. So when you try to, when people say, like, well, we might go to war with Iran. Well, we're going to go to war with Ukraine. We're going to go to war, you know, in the Middle East with Hamas and Israel. I mean, it's nonstop. And I like it better, you know, than actually going to war. But it's, you know, it's become like these these mass shootings that everybody, you know, wonders about the theatrical aspects to them. Maybe this is they're just going to put on these productions. But maybe they realize, too, that if they tried to give a real war, that Americans, especially, I don't know what the millennial Gen Z, I don't know that they could get them to go. I don't know what they would do, but I think it'd be very difficult. They'd have to have a draft, and not that they, you know, they've done that plenty of times before, but I don't know where it's going. But I was concentrating on this Texas situation because I think that's I don't know what it means, but it's exciting to, even though somebody like Abbott is a very unlikely hero in this, because he's been in governor for like 10 years and he really hasn't done anything but ship migrants around. Well,
okay, here, you've just said something interesting. He's been there for 10 years. Do you know where he is now or was?
India.
Maybe. Yeah, he's been gone in India for 2 weeks. He wasn't even in Texas.
Yeah,
he's been phoning it in.
Kind of a curious, curious place to take a stand. Last stand at the Alamo, but yeah, it's so, you know, Texas, of course, has that history of the Alamo. So that's like, you might expect kind of a constitutional battle to go in there, but I don't know what it means. I don't the trucker convoy. We saw what happened the last time when Americans tried to mimic the. Excuse me, very impressive Canadian trucker convoy. And you remember almost nobody showed up. So we'll see.
You know what I think, Don? I think what's going to happen is exactly within plus or minus 5% what they want to happen. I'm not sitting on the edge of my seat spilling popcorn all over the place. This is all programmed, all of it. Yeah. And I also would go back to the beginning of our nation, when those really wonderful warnings were issued by Jefferson, Franklin, Adams, and so forth about, you know, we've given you this gift, or we have this gift. You don't protect it, you're going to lose it. Right. You're going to lose it. And if you look back and figure that 95% of the history of this country has seen it involved in some kind of military conflict in some other location, not at home, who won the war? Who's running this show here, really? Exactly. Is it still the Blue Bloods and the Crown? Mm-hmm. Were they still running this thing? I think an argument might be made for that. I don't think Americans, having fought and won their freedom and independence, would have chosen a path of international interference like this. Washington. I think, come on, they all. Anyway, go ahead.
Washington's farewell address, John Quincy Adams, that America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. I mean, nobody, none of the founding, they would be appalled at this ridiculous foreign policy that we've had really since 1917, I guess, or whenever America entered World War I, well, even the 1898, if you want to say that, with the Spanish-American War, the first modern false flag, or so-called modern, I guess you could call 1898 modern. But I think that I don't think it's any accident that right after, regardless of how, you know, real the Texas border situation was, because what happens is they do throw these things out there, and obviously they control the narrative. But presumably there are some truckers, for instance, and some citizens that might legitimately, excuse me, respond to the narrative. And they're not part of it, and they may go there with good intents. I think that's what happens in a lot of riots and protests, is that most of the people go there, they have the government plans to control things and throw the first, you know, pipe bomb, or, you know, break the first window, and, you know, incite people and direct them where to riot. So you have, you know, black people rioting always in their own neighborhoods and destroying their own houses and businesses and not walking a couple blocks over into gated communities where they can maybe make a statement, because they keep things controlled. And they, so I think that if even something like that, where it's controlled, it's interesting. As soon as this became a big story for a couple of days, suddenly it's off the front page now, because now they're on to something international again, Iran. And I don't believe for a second anything they say about any of the guys, especially Iran.
Especially Iran. Yes.
Especially that, because Iran, I mean, I've known so many Iranians in my life, Jeff, because my sister married an Iranian. She lived in Iran for many years. He speaks fluent Farsi. And, everyone I've met has been very nice, and I've never met one fanatic. And
they don't try to push their religion on people. I've never seen that happen.
Not at all. To me, I mean, they come off more favorably than most American citizens I meet. But, my sister would say, you know, that, you know, if you lived in Iran, this is the idea that this country is a threat to America, just like Iraq. It's the same kind of thing. There are no threat to anybody, and they can keep trying to. And I've asked people to explain, what does it mean, the state sponsor of terrorism? What does that mean? How do they sponsor them? How have you proven that they sponsor terrorism? And you haven't even proven there is terrorism. You know, it's one man's terrorism is another freedom fighters, right? If we had lost the Revolutionary War, George Washington, Jefferson, all these guys would have been terrorists, or whatever they wanted to call them, traitors or whatever at the time. So it's whether you win. And so the terrorists, so-called, it all comes from Israel, and all this ties to Israel, because Israel was created, illegally, if you will. They were carved out into land.
Oh, absolutely. By international law. You bet.
Yeah. And this is the problem we find with states like Iran or Iraq or really anywhere over there. It's always our foreign policy has to constantly revolve around Israel's enemies, and they have a special antipathy for Iran for some reason. I don't know why. And because they really have never battled them, but they have been aching for. So I'm not saying it's impossible that we would go to war on Israel's, and it would be on Israel's behalf, because what beef do we have with Iran? If Iran really did shoot a drone and kill, if they really did that. And again, I'm dubious of anything they report about a foreign boogeyman, especially because the foreign boogeyman happens to be Israel's enemy. So anything you say about one of Israel's enemies, you know, to me, it's worthless to hear. It's like talking about Hitler back in the 1930s. I mean, this is somebody that they don't like, or a country they don't like, for whatever reason. So even if it was true, they don't represent, they if they did do that to American servicemen, they were doing it to make a point with Israel, against Israel, because they hate us because of our sponsors. You're talking about state sponsorship. What is America but the state sponsor of Israel? I mean, we sponsor Israel. We paid for pretty much everything they have. We built them up in the third most powerful military in the world, when they're the size of a postage stamp, you know, like size of Rhode Island or whatever. And they have the third most powerful military in the world, 100% because of us, the American taxpayer. So, you know, and I think more people, especially after the Hamas thing, because they built up this anti-white great replacement thing. And that involves hatred of all whites, and the Palestinians and blacks and all the people that are now, you know, very pro-Palestinian in America. Because they see Israel as white colonials, and they don't see them as special people or whatever the, you know, Israelis think of themselves, because they apparently don't think they're white. I don't know what they think they are, but they see themselves as a special breed or whatever. God's chosen, or even though they don't believe in God, whatever they do from largely. But, you know, so the idea that
the bottom line, Don, in my opinion, they're two-toned. They're Eastern European white, and they're Middle Eastern, genetically speaking, olive-skinned. They're, those are the real Semites. People know this now. They're catching on. So they're kind of, it's a duplicitous race. They're whatever they want to be. They'll just play it. They know they can lie, and they know they can get away with it, because they know how stupid most other people are in comparison, and they are very well educated and trained from birth to death in the school system, the culture, constantly told that they're better than anybody else. Just don't talk about it. Keep it quiet. But we're better. So it's quite a scene. They really are. You understand, I think, one understands how they have been thrown out of and expelled from over 1,000 different cities, nations, countries in the last 3,000 years, because they cause mischief, trouble, problems. Yeah. They control. Their greed is endless. That's what they are as a people. Now, there are exceptions, and some of you are listening right now. You don't buy into that stuff. But when the bell rings, 95% of Jews are going to answer it.
Right.
To fight for the cause of supremacy. I'm telling you, that's the way it looks here anyway.
Well, the people...
Jewish supremacism. Go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, white people in general, again, white Americans especially, we have so little solidarity with each other. We have absolutely no...
Not anymore. It's fractured. You're right. It's blown to pieces. Humpty Dumpty.
But you have other, it's not just Jews, but it's also blacks are very, very solid. You know, they support each other. Asians, Chinese, I mean, every other group, again.
It's all fragmented now. That's right.
All fragmented. And we're trained to, in fact, go against people that look like us, white people. You know, we instinctively, most of us would side with someone. I think that's, and I'm not saying you should blindly support. I mean, I've got problems. I mean, to me, I think, you know, the problem all this is because white people have capitulated and allowed all this to happen and haven't used their huge advantage in numbers and haven't supported each other. Because in any of these cases, just if there is solidarity and you support each other, then you can get great things accomplished. But that's on the larger picture in terms of why we allow this small group at the top to rule us. Why we have these conspirators ruling everybody, it's because the great mass of people like the Proles and Orwell's 1984, they will not come together. They're incapable of doing it. They can't. They have such a huge advantage in numbers, and they're basically like a huge neighborhood of thousands of people, and one guy is walking down the street and bossing everybody around,
right,
and telling everybody what to do. And no one will. Everybody's scared to fight back. I mean, that's the situation we're in, and that's
your construction, saying that we allow them to control us. I understood what you're saying, but in reality, we're not allowing anything. We're being dictated to. Those days of allowing are over. We can't do anything through the ballot box. You all know that. So I don't know. Yeah, we're allowing it because we're not out in the streets putting a stop to it. But other than that, we're just fish in a barrel. That's it. Hold on a second. Don and I'll be right back. And welcome back. Glad to have you on board. Let me make a real quick mention here to all of you out there who have ordered Oxy-C. I'm still waiting for inventory from the manufacturer and the handler. And something happened over the Christmas holidays. They were wiped out. And I really apologize. I'm getting notes from people that, where's our order? And it should be here. If it doesn't show up here relatively soon, we'll just send out refunds. There aren't that many, but we appreciate your kindness and your understanding. Things are not like they used to be, no matter where you look. All right, we're talking with Donald Jeffries. And again, Don's books are second to none in this society of ours, except maybe John Barber's book, huh? All right.
Nobody beats John Barber. And I wrote the foreword to that book, so I'm a part of it.
That's right. That's right. Had John on last, how was it, Wednesday? No, it was Friday, a first hour instead of third hour, and it had Carol Honig on with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a nice hour. He wants to come back right after the Academy Awards, as I told you, and bring her on again. So maybe we'll mix that in with you if you like. We'll have fun with that. And we had some, God, that one story about how, his review of Deep Throat in court, what he said in court. Oh, my.
Yeah.
You see the link at the top of John Barber on the left side of the homepage. Go listen to the hour. It's what you'll enjoy it. He's just amazing. Amazing.
He is amazing. I hope he's listening. But he's like I said, it's my most rewarding friendship I've ever had. I never thought I would be close friends with someone like that. I mean, you know,
that's very special. Very special.
It is. I mean, it's just how we hooked up is beyond belief. I mean, he's, you know, he's old enough to be my dad, and he's, you know, he's Mr. Show Business, and you know,
I mean,
just
come on, you know John. I know John not as well as you probably, but I mean, that story of him when he worked in the mail room at the studios at Paramount. I think it was Paramount.
Yeah.
Was it Paramount? And Cary Grant drove by in a convertible and tried to entice him into the car to go out for breakfast.
And he told now he can't remember which one it was, but he told me it was
of course,
either
he said
Joe.
He did not get in the car. He keeps saying that. We'll let that
ride. Well, it must have been, you know, Cary Grant was a good-looking, incredible-looking man. So that must have been tempting. he couldn't remember if it was Joan Blondell or Ann Southern. They had a picture of her, he claimed in the, and he didn't describe it too much, but he just said a picture of one of them with no underwear. I don't even know what that meant, if you could see up the dress or whatever. And they hung it on the wall there, and I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to have in the house. And I, of course, I'm thinking, because I really love Joan Blondell. I thought she was, you know, one of the most gorgeous women in Hollywood. I said, was it Joan Blondell? Do you remember? And he says, I can't remember, Donald. So, but.
Where was this picture? Hanging in his office on the wall?
No. I guess the boys in the mailroom had it hung up down there. Maybe they,
back in the day.
Maybe to the executive. Yeah. But I thought that was, you know, that was such a cool thing. But he, you know, people. I realize when you hear him talking these shows, I mean, this guy, he knew everybody. You know, you look at those tapes of shows when one of his sidekicks on his, because he had all these shows that would just come and go really quick. And he had a brief show where he had Brian Gumbel with his huge afro, a young Brian Gumbel was his sidekick. And he was, when he was the critic on, I guess, is it KABC or I think it was KNBC, whatever
KNBC.
One Tom Brokaw.
No, KNBC.
Yeah. Yeah, KNBC and Tom Brokaw and Tom Snyder were like the anchors on there with him. Went on to bigger and better things. So, anyway, it's great. So when he calls me and we just talk about that, it's just amazing. So I never, because my wife was especially was a huge fan of Real People, and her sister went out to LA. And we used to have a VHS tape of it because they taped it, or I don't know how they taped it or somehow, but. They got a tape of them sitting in the audience, Real People. You know, they went into a recording of it. So I told them, man, we used to have that recording. We used to watch it and try to find them in the audience. But anyway, he's a down to earth guy.
He as successful as he was, and it was big. He could have been 10 times more successful if he'd played the game. But he's a man of principle.
Yeah, he is. He was. He's not going to be. He's not going to compromise at all. And he was, and he, like he says, I mean, I know that his JFK stuff, that's what killed his career for good, because he was on top of the world of Real People. And once he got involved interviewing Jim Garrison, and suddenly all of it dried up. And you can see when he wrote his book, he should have been able to get a bigger publisher. And I know Carol, I think it was Carol or somebody, he had a publicist that he hired that sent out things to all the media, you know, and then I sent out a bunch of stuff to KNBC, where he was a film critic for, I think, 5 years. I think it's an LA magazine.
More than that.
Or maybe more, but maybe a decade. And he was a critic for a number of years at Los Angeles magazine, LA magazine, I think. And they didn't respond to me, just like they didn't respond. So I don't, you know, it's just, it has to be, and I think he admits that now, it has to be the JFK thing. But that's just shows you how people, you know, they can blacklist somebody. And, you know, but he came off better than Freddie Prinze. You know, Freddie Prinze was the top young comedian of the era there in 1977 when he killed himself, supposedly. And I've told that story before. I was at Mark Lane's when I was working as a teenage volunteer. I was at his office stuffing envelopes, and he came and told me and another teenager, he was all excited talking about Freddie Prinze calling him from Hollywood and how Freddie Prinze was obsessed with the JFK assassination, and all he did was watch the Zapruder film over and over again. And he said he wants to give a telethon to raise funds for an investigation, because that's what we were doing. We were trying to lobby Congress to reopen the investigation, which became the House Select Committee on Assassination. It's very disappointing, but that's what we were working towards. And if I hadn't have been there at his office that day, I think it was a month or two later, he supposedly killed himself. I would have never had any idea to connect him to the JFK assassination. And when they did one of those movies of the week, which they used to do back then, where they, the last days of Freddie Prinze or something.
Freddie Prinze. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was all based on, it was all revolved around his drug usage. He was out of control, waving a gun around. Not one word about the JFK assassination. And I know for a fact that he was watching the cover up.
It's just another cover up.
And John Belushi was the same way. I didn't find out for a long time. We discovered that Dick Gregory had left a thing in there when he said, you know, the night before John Belushi died, he left him he called him up and said, hey, look, I need to talk to Mark Lane. You know, he was obsessed with the JFK assassination too. He said, I want to talk to him. I got some information for him. Boom. Next day he's dead.
And they OD'd him, I think.
Yeah. Same kind of thing. Oh yeah. Dick Gregory, you know, it was great the way he would just throw, stuff out there. He goes, you know, this, the woman, yeah, she was probably connected to the CIA, and she, you know, they definitely knocked him off. But so who knows how many other people are like that. When you see a lot of the deaths I talked about in my book, On Barred Fame, when John Barber wrote the foreword to that, he kind of reciprocated for me writing the foreword to his book. I went over a lot of those unnatural deaths, and who knows how many others might've been connected to something like that. Hollywood is so full of weird deaths. And you
remember the
book,
Hollywood Babylon? Remember that book?
Oh yes. Kenneth Anger. He just died last year, or the year before. He was well into his 90s. But yeah, that guy was that was one of my favorite books as a young man. And I it turned out later that he was kind of like Penn Jones was in the JFK assassination, where I love Penn Jones' books too, but Penn Jones got some things wrong later, you found out. And Kenneth Anger did too. But he made up some greats. You know, the stories he told were incredible. And it was a fat, and he got some pictures. You know, he had naked pictures of some of these old starlets. I don't know where the hell he got them from. But he published them, and he went back to Hollywood. You know, Kenneth Anger was a child actor. He was in, he played a role, what was the name of that? It was 1935, Midsummer Night's Dream, I think it was, 1935, the film, big film. And he had a little bit of a career there, but he was into some weird stuff. I don't know if he was a Satanist or whatever, but the book was, you know, was very, it was one of those things like a train wreck, where you can't turn your eyes away from it. I was very influenced by that, and that's one of the
lurid
reasons.
Lurid.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we can't... It's hard to resist that kind of stuff, but John Barber was in a world, and so it fascinates me, you know, too, because I told him, I said, you know, I'm a community college dropout. I was a blue collar worker for a long time. Then I was in IT, and I wasn't very high up in there. And so, I watched you on TV, you know, same thing I tell, you know, Susan Olsen, who's become my friend, who played Cindy on the Brady Bunch. She's really in our world. She's a real conspiracy person. She's been on my show several times. She's a really, really cool person. And I tell her, you know, it's just surrealistic to be friends with people like that when you only know them as figures on a television set.
Well, to borrow a punchline, they're just real people when it comes right down to it.
Exactly.
They don't walk on water.
No, absolutely. Yeah, that was really the motivation for my book On Barred Fame, and why I called up that title On Barred Fame, because that's really
it's a great title.
What it is.
Great title.
Well, I think it's just kind of self-explanatory that fame is
perfect title. Yeah.
Is it because it really does last for 15 minutes? And ironically, Andy Warhol's the one who came up with that title. I mean, came up with that. Everyone in the future, everyone would be famous for 15 minutes. And that's all he's remembered for. He's saying that. So, you know,
I remember the can of Campbell's tomato soup.
Yeah. I mean, you know, his artwork is not going to, the picture bound. I mean, this, he didn't produce, I don't think, enduring art. And I had a woman that was in his entourage for a while I get the weirdest people that contact me that like my work, and she loves my work. Uh-huh. And for a while she was, I wouldn't say stalking me, but she was following me everywhere on the internet, listening to my show and stuff, but very critical. You know, she had been a beautiful woman at one time, and she was very kind of, it was old and sick and very critical of everything. And so she would lecture me. And of course she was Jewish, but she liked me talking about Jews, you know, so she was a very interesting character, but I did something to her. I don't know what it was to offend her finally. And she fled, you know, although I did recently, she popped up somewhere when I saw, she might be listening to this show for all I know, but you know, I found her fascinating because of, you know, she talked about like having lunch with a young Robert De Niro and Jack Nicholson and things, because she was in Andy Warhol's entourage. Uh-huh. And so they knew all these celebrities. So, but I mean, you know, decades later, she was financially strapped, and she's, you know, looking at somebody like me, you know, interested in my work. So that kind of stuff fascinates me, you know, that people could.
I understand. I do. I get it. The good thing about the program with Johnny on Friday was that at the end, I think, you know, I pushed him into doing the first book.
Yeah.
Your Mother's Not a Virgin. I pushed him so hard. On the air, I embarrassed him, and he finally did it. And I told Carol, I said, you got to promise me. I didn't know that Carol Honig edited that book. She edited it. Mm-hmm. And I said, Carol, you got to promise me we're going to get the volume 2. It's already written. Mm-hmm. We just need you to edit it. Will you promise me you'll do that? We've got, and John kind of, he's not a big pusher of the book per se. He loves the book, but he's got another one sitting there ready to go. Another 300 and almost 400 pages. I said, geez, come on.
Well, it should have been, like I said, that book should have been talked about in the media, especially the media where he worked. I mean, you know, I mean, certainly K and
the only book of its kind. To chronicle that period of American television show business.
No, because it's so well written. He's, you know, he's obviously a great writer, and it's very funny. And I described it. He loves the way, you know, I described it in my foreword. I said it's like David Copperfield goes to Hollywood, and that's what it was. I mean, he came from, you know, really kind of
nice image.
Just, you know, better, a really terrible background, you know, and you know, I don't want to go through that, but he didn't have a good childhood, didn't have a happy childhood, Canadian runaway, and then he sneaks into the country, and, you know, for the rest is history. He was really kind of a Horatio Alger story from that point on, and now he's 90 years old, and he has the enthusiasm of a teenager. So it's amazing. He was talking last week, and he said, I spent the last couple days paring down my Facebook list because I haven't heard. I got 5,000 friends, and I haven't heard from 4,000 of them, you know, in years. So, I mean, if you've ever tried to, well, you're not on social media, I guess, but I've tried sometimes to get rid of some of my Facebook friends because I have a bunch of friend requests. I'm at the maximum, too, and I have a bunch of friend requests that I can't fit them in, and I know I have a bunch of people that I don't know why I have them. And but it's really time-consuming. It's very tedious. It's not easy, but John, you know, managed to do that. He got rid of four. I said, yeah, how long did that take you? That's a very long procedure. So that's how he, you know, he's that energetic and that, you know, if he wants to, he can be tenacious about doing that stuff. But anyhow, he's listening because we're talking so much about him.
I'm looking forward to the next book because the title is already there. Your Mother is Not a Virgin. Your Mother's Still Not a Virgin. Whatever. It can be real simple.
Your Mother's Still Not a Virgin. I like that. Yeah.
But, so, I mean, the book's there, and he's got stories. He's probably forgotten more stories than he remembers. I mean, there's too many of them. Yeah. If he goes digging, they're all there. But, anyway, it's a classic.
It is. Well, it is. It is incredible. So, and you're really responsible. And he does he acknowledges that he, I don't know how long ago he was before me, obviously coming on your show, but you kind of brought him back because I don't know how you interacted with him, but he was forgotten and kind of blackballed by the media for a long time. And he gives you credit. He's told me many times, you know, Jeff is the one that he's the only one that wanted me on the show, you know, wanted to talk to me and, you know, became kind of a regular feature with you and people loved him and stuff, but he wasn't being asked to certainly to come on any mainstream media. And,
it kind of did revitalize, his career as such. Now he's an icon. He's a treasured icon and a valued guest on anybody's talk program that would do the kinds of things that we do.
No, and
he deserves it.
It's the right thing. We are critical. You know, and of course, I'm part of the JFK research community. My newest book is about JFK, The Pipe That Bimon Read, about Dean Andrews, my friendship with Dean Andrews III, who was Dean Andrews Jr., the beatnik lawyer played by John Candy in Oliver Stone's film, who was an integral part, you know, of Garrison's investigation. But I've said for a long time, John and I have commiserated that we badmouth, you know, and talk about how these other critics, the research community is horrible. And it's in a microcosm of what's wrong with America. And basically even the alt media in general, where you see there's so many egos and infighting and they can't come together to pursue the simple truth. The official story was wrong. Let's prove that. Let's first of all demonstrate that they framed Lee Harvey Oswald. They lied about him and covering up forever. So they lied. That's wrong. Okay, now let's figure out what happened and why did they lie. But they can't do that. Instead, they just keep going on different roads and they don't like me. They clearly don't like me. They ignore me like the plague. And no matter, you know, it doesn't matter how many books I write. And they're ignoring this JFK book for the most part. But John Barber should, logically, he should be the dean of that community. He should be the, you know, when they had these conferences in Dallas that I'm never invited to.
He should be
the MC there. And they have another guy, too, that's Joe McBride, who's a part of the JFK research community, who's also has a background in Hollywood. He was an assistant to Orson Welles, and he's written lots of well-received books, including. He's a real kind of a mainstream figure, but he's drifted over into my world. I had him on my show a couple of times, but he's a brilliant guy. I mean, you have people like, John Barber and Joe McBride. Those are the kind of people that have names outside of it, and they could, but they're both ignored, and you know, I don't know why, but John and I have talked about it many times, and that's why. So if you ever wonder why, you know, nobody ever gets anywhere on that, but you can look at 9/11 research or any of these other kinds of things. It's the same kind of things. They're just huge egos, or these kinds of issues, whether it's JFK, 9/11, school shootings, any of these things. They draw very extreme personalities. They draw big egos a lot of times, and people that are so sure about, and they'll argue over something. And I don't do that. I don't agree with a lot of them, but I'm willing to have them as a comrade. And I try to stress, let's work together on what we agree on. That, you know, the official story is wrong, was a purposeful lie, and that they've been covering it up. But they can't see that. And so that's why it's a microcosm what you see in society at large, where I talked before about how you can't get people to come together. And if you can't even get people that are awake.
It's harder now than ever.
Yeah.
I think.
But when you get people like in our world that know about all the conspiracies and corruption and cover-ups, they know it's there and they still can't come together. What does that say? I mean, we know the people, the so-called normies, that they're hopeless because they don't think there is any corruption. they actually look around and apparently they think our mainstream media is like free. You know, this is their.
They also actually say that Biden's doing a pretty good job. Some of them actually say that.
Yeah.
They'll
say, it's like, you know, what is that? How is he? I mean, he's not
doing
anything.
Terminal stupidity. There's just no way to rehabilitate that.
I mean, go to the grocery store, go to the gas pump. I mean, those used to be like the most important hot button issues, but somehow, but again, it's because I saw they were interviewing Jay Leno, and I didn't like Jay Leno that much, but I liked Letterman better. But Letterman has, years ago, both of them used to be, they weren't classic, you know, leftists. And I think Letterman used to claim he was a libertarian, and Jay Leno used to have Ron Paul on a show a lot. But they, because of Trump, they both got Trump derangement syndrome. They sound like, if they had a show today, it would be just like Jimmy Kimmel and Colbert. All it is, Jay Leno is making fun of the truckers and saying, like, you know, this is the guy who has, like, you know.
Those programs are obscenities in terms of being even referred to as comedic in any sense. They're sickening.
But it shows you, in the case of Letterman and Leno, they would not be reacting that way if it wasn't for Trump. And that's why I call it the Trumpenstein Project. And he's in all this. He was inserted into the body politic to cause this, to create the division. And that's why you see. So you have people that are defending massive surges of immigrants. The Supreme Court, look, think about that, Jeff. The Supreme Court, the top law, the law of the land, ruled that the authorities don't have a right to put up a barbed wire fence. That's not even much of an impediment, but feds can go in there and cut that down. I mean, so what is the Supreme Court saying? They're giving their stamp of approval to wide open borders. So that's
three of those five votes were Trump appointees, as we know.
Yes, that was his greatest accomplishment, according to Spurs. Yeah, I guess you don't like those justices. Well, they're not going along with his rhetoric, that's for sure.
Nothing much did, in actuality. It just didn't. He talked such a great game.
Yep.
He could have gone down in history as, truly, even if it had cost him his life, he could have gone down as one of the great presidents, the great presidents, but he didn't.
He just done one-tenth of what he said, yep.
Yep, agreed. Don, you be careful out there. Take care. Okay. Talk to you next week.
Take care. Thanks. Take care.
Okay, we'll be right back with hour two for you next.